God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. You can unmute yourself, I believe, at this time, or if you want to raise your hand virtually, we'll come to you. Anybody? I'm not seeing anybody. Well, if you're shy, feel free to message one of the hosts and definitely hang out after the meeting so we can get to know you, have a little bit of time to socialize. All right. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to welcome Charlie P. from Austin, Texas, to tell his story. After Charlie tells his story from roughly 7 to 8, we're going to give them a little break and do some housekeeping, take some announcements and seventh tradition. And then we'll spend the next half hour asking Charlie questions. Once again, please send your questions that you think of to the user questions. And as I just said, our speaker tonight is Charlie P. I'm super excited to hear what he has to say, share his experience, strength, and hope. So I won't take up another minute of his time. Charlie.
Thanks, BJ. Great job. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful alcoholic and happy to be here with you guys tonight. I was expecting more reading than that. I swear, some groups, when by the time you get ready to go, it feels like they're going to go, now Dan's going to read the Old Testament, and you're just like, oh my God, but I'm anxious to get going. So here we go. My home group is the primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Austin, Texas. We meet on Wednesday nights on Zoom. We have our live meeting on Tuesday night. And before the whole pandemic thing started, we were having 225 people on a Tuesday night studying the big book live in Austin, Texas. And it's just a lot. We study the book line by line, week after week, and it's just a lot more fun than it sounds like. When we started doing the Zoom thing, we had so many people. We had friends from all over the world coming to the Zoom meetings. At one point, there was like 600 people. So we couldn't just shut the door on it. So when we went back to meeting live in person, we moved our Zoom meeting to Wednesday nights. And I'm just posting it. I was posting it. It's not going to let me post. I guess I've turned off the chat. When you turn the chat back on, I'll post the information for our home group at some point. But we'd love for you to come join us on a Wednesday night. We meet at 7:30 p.m. Central Time Zone on Wednesday nights. I'm excited to be here. It's funny thing, my circumstances are a little different than I was expecting. I came up here I live in Austin. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. But I've been in Austin for over 40 years, and I came up here Monday night to go to my sainted mother's 98th birthday. And I got up here. My mom's 98, and she may make a cameo appearance if she's going between here and her bedroom, but she's adorable. She still lives on her own at 98 years old in a 3,600 square foot house, takes care of herself. We're very, very fortunate to have her. But Oh, I came up here on Monday night, and then we got this historic ice storm on starting about Tuesday. And it was like, I can't go home and run the risk of her not having heat or power or something like that. And it's looking like I might be here till next Thursday or Friday. So I've had to make some arrangements. I went out and I went to a thrift store on Friday and bought a jacket and a tie because, you know, if you see my sponsor, tell him I had a coat and tie on. It may not be important to everybody, but it's real important to them. And it always reminds me, I was telling David a story earlier. I was trained that way. And, oh, God, I guess 35 years ago or so, I can't remember whether I was reading at a conference or introducing somebody. And I knew I was getting up behind the podium and I was really excited. And my sponsor took me aside and he goes, Charlie, you know, it's okay if you don't want to wear a coat and tie this Saturday at the podium. And I went, oh, good. He goes, I mean, you still have to wear one, but it's okay if you don't want to, you know. It's like, it's kind of been that way ever since, you know. It's like, you know, we don't really care, you know, your willingness is not a huge piece of it, but I'm happy to be here dressed. And then I went to Half Price Books and bought a used big book. This belonged to Kim originally, K-Y-M. And at first I was a little worried about Kim because her book is pretty clean. And it wound up at Half Price Books. But as I'm going through it, some of her notes are pretty good. I mean, there's a chance Kim might have made it. You know, she's got a lot of the pertinent stuff underlined and dog-eared and stuff like that. And hopefully we'll get around to talking about some of that stuff tonight. And I had to go buy a new computer, too. Other than that, I was ready to go. But now we have a computer at my mother's house, so life is good. And you guys look great. It's a fine-looking group. I'm happy to be here. Now, Katie said to say hi. Some of you know Katie. And I see some of my sponsees and favorite guys on here. And I'm real happy to see you guys on here. Good to see Carl from New Zealand. That really is a live picture. That's not his screenshot. He just doesn't move very much. You know. But anyway, John and Tony, good to see you guys. And so, you know, I hope you can bear with my voice tonight. I've had some throat issues since about 2012, and I'm scheduled for another surgery on March 8th. And we know enough to know that it's not cancer. And if you guys can bear with me for the hour, I'll get through the talk, but I probably won't be hitting any high notes tonight. I mean, this is about as sweet as it gets, you know. You know, my job when I'm telling my story is to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And in AA, we talk about coming out of our own experience. And it's a very important part of what we do in our stories is telling our own experience. And it always reminds me of this joke. There's a joke I like to tell to warm up the room. And some of you guys, my sponsees can go to the bathroom now if you need to. So I know they've heard this joke before. Some of you guys have heard this joke before. Some of you have heard me tell this joke before. But it's a good joke, and I like the way I tell it. So here it comes. And it's about this guy. When we talk about coming out of experience, it reminds me of this guy. He's driving along one day, and he's passing by this farmhouse, and he sees a sign on the gatepost, and it says, talking dog for sale. He can't stand it. He goes up to the farmhouse where this old farmer's sitting there, and he goes, so you got a talking dog for sale? And the guy goes, yeah, he's around back. And he walks around back and there's this old red hound dog laying on the ground. He looks at the dog and he goes, so you can talk? And the dog says, well, I certainly can. And he goes, my God, how did that happen? And he goes, well, it's actually a very interesting story. He said, when I was young, I started picking up some language skills from some of the humans that I interacted with. And as I got older, I started developing some of the nuances of the language. I started working with slang and colloquialisms and local expressions. And it's made for a fabulous life for me. He said, I had a 19-year career in the Drug Enforcement Administration. I was able to infiltrate some scenes that no human agent would have ever been able to get into. And he said, I've traveled the world, stayed in some of the finest hotels, eaten the cooking of some of the world's greatest chefs. But really, more interesting than me, some of my pups have learned foreign language skills and have become international diplomats. He said, in fact, two of my pups are in the United Nations building right now as international diplomats. And the guy goes, he's just blown away. And he goes, my God, it's just been fascinating talking to you. And he walks back up front where that farmer's sitting there and he goes, man, how much do you want for that dog? The farmer thinks about it and he goes, I don't know, $40? And he goes, why on earth would you ever sell a fabulous dog like that for 40 bucks? And the farmer thinks for a second and he goes, none of that crap he told you is true. And it's kind of like that around here. It doesn't really matter how good the story is if it's not my experience, because we drunks can smell a line of BS from a mile away. So I want to get into it. But I mean, because I'm, I come from Dallas, Texas. I'm in Dallas tonight, but I live in Austin, and I'm in the house that a lot of my bottom took place in. But I come from a relatively normal family. I mean, I don't know exactly what a functional family looks like, but I know I've heard enough fifth steps over the years to know that a lot of my sponsors, a lot of people had it a lot worse than I did growing up. I come from, my parents stayed together. There was no drinking in our household, no violence. We grew up Southern Baptist, and that everything that came with that. Just relatively normal. My dad was a salesman, and my sainted 98-year-old mother was a school teacher for 42 years. She taught first grade for 42 years. And let me tell you, I was damn well prepared for the first grade. I, in fact, kind of kicked ass, if you have to know. I did a couple of things. Other things were going on. I did. Anybody else grow up under the burden of potential? Just by a show of hands, any, oh my God. All I heard about was, why can't you live up to your potential? If you could just apply yourself, why can't you be more like Charles Mallier across the street? And I remember thinking, well, that's flattering, Mom, but I'm really not holding back that much. You're kind of getting my best shot at it here. But, I also had a sister that was a high achiever. My sister was all everything. She's 5 years older than I am. She was National Honor Society, first chair flute player, drum major at, really beautiful. And then me, it's kind of thuggish little brother coming up behind her. I say all that. I want to get through this fairly quickly, but none of that stuff made me alcoholic. In fact, that's an interesting point. I think a lot of us get here trying to figure out what it is that made me alcoholic, what made me have to get so loaded. And the more I've looked into it, I've been sober. I didn't get my sobriety day. My sobriety day is March 22nd of 1985, and I'm truly grateful for that. I'm 64 years old. I've been sober 35 years. The only downside is my wife, Katie, has 5 months more than I do. And that's a point of contention in our home. There are times if I'm struggling, Katie will say, honey, just hang in there for 5 more months and it'll all make more sense to you, But we have a good time. AA is alive and well in our house. And I love Katie, and get a chance to listen to her sometime. But, I'm not even really sure how important it is what made me alcoholic. It's kind of like if you're out hiking in the forest, and you come around the corner of a trail and there's a mountain lion getting ready to pounce on you. It doesn't really matter how he got there. It's not like you're going to stop and go, well, now that's odd. Mountain lions are not typical for this region. We just got to deal with the problem. And it's kind of that way with the alcoholism. I don't know, but I've come to believe that it's a genetic bullet. And I caught it and my sister didn't. I was quite a bit older. There was a lot of alcoholism on my father's side of the family, but not my father. And then there was some on my mother's side of the family. I didn't find out till much later. But on page 30, it says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. Well, two things happen in that sentence. One is, do you ever ask yourself who the we is? People talk about how the big book is a we thing. You know who we is most of the time when it mentions it in the big book? In the foreword to the first edition, it said, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from what? From a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. is the main purpose of this book. So the we they're talking about, most of the book is written from their perspective as recovered alcoholics, people who have experienced the spiritual awakening and the freedom that comes from the greatest gift that God can give an alcoholic of my variety, and that's freedom from this hopeless state of mind and body that the book describes in the first doctor's opinion, in the first 44 pages of the book. But to sum it up, you know, it says that we have to fully concede to our innermost selves. Before I can fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, I best know what it means to be alcoholic, you know? And it turns out that as an alcoholic, I have two problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it. The other one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I don't struggle with alcohol. That's supposed to be a joke, y'all. I like to tell a little joke to make sure everybody's not staring at the little boxes on their screen. That's where, this is my invitation to somebody in an AA meeting this day. Sometimes it's a little creepy. You know, there's some guys I want to chat them up and go, hey, dude, lighten up a little bit. You're looking kind of creepy there, you know, but I'm off the topic here a little bit. I should tell you, I got a little ADD working up here. And there are times during my talk where I'll say, we're going to get back to that later. And what that means is that this ain't the right time to introduce that particular piece of information. But when I tell you we're coming back to it, we're probably not coming back. I mean, I always get real excited when I actually circle back around to one. But I'm going to give it my best shot. And it turns out two problems with alcohol. The first one is what happens to me when I drink it, the physical aspect of alcoholism. And the book describes it in the doctor's opinion in the first 23 pages of the book. And it says, we believe it's so suggested a few years ago. Silkworth had written a paper a few years earlier. In that paper, he had suggested that the action of alcohol on who? On these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. And I like to break this down because this is not language that I ever use. None of us, I mean, think about it. I mean, I used to drink a little place about 3/4 of a mile from here called the Spillway Pub. And I promise you, I never once wandered in the Spillway Pub of an evening and went, oh, Bobby, God almighty, the spiritual malady is on me today, you know? And I had a beer on the way over here and it has triggered a phenomenon of craving. It's kicking my young butt. I mean, nobody talked like that. I mean, this is all stuff I've learned since I got here. But when it says an allergy, it's an abnormal physical reaction. And the book says any description of alcoholism that leaves out this physical aspect of it is incomplete, because something happens when I drink 4 ounces of vodka that doesn't happen to 90% of the population. Only about 10% of the population even has the capacity to become alcoholic because of this physical aspect that causes the phenomenon of craving. Phenomenon means we don't really know why it happens, but we know it happens. But the thing about when it says I trigger a phenomenon of craving, when I drink, it triggers a craving for more booze that's more powerful than I am. Once I start drinking, I can't control how much I'm going to drink. And the most important thing, we talk about turning statements in the big book into questions. The most important thing you can do with anything I say, or anything this book says, is lay it up against your experience and see if it's a fit. Is this me? Is this what happens to me when I drink? Is this my current, throughout the book, is when it makes statements, I turn them into questions. Is this my current belief based on what I know from my experience in AA and the big book? Well, the problem with this, the tricky thing about this phenomenon of craving is that I never thought I'd triggered the phenomenon of craving when I'd go off on a bender. I just thought I'd changed my mind, right? Anybody go out to have a couple of drinks? You know, the guys at work go, hey, we're going to go have a couple of beers after work. You want to join us? I'm like, yes, I do. I absolutely would like to go with you. And they're going to go to the pool hall. And then, you know, after a couple of beers, something happens to me and they go, hey, listen, man, I got to bounce. My wife's making spaghetti at the house. Go ahead. You know, I've changed my mind. You know, I got a different, I mean, I always have a different plan. I'll leave in 30 minutes. I'll meet you at dinner. I'll see you later tonight. I'll see you in the morning. But the result is always and I can't control how much I'm going to drink. And it goes, it says a lot about it in the doctor's opinion. And Roman numeral 28 is a heavy page that needs to be. Let me see if Kim has beat up. Let me see if Kim has beat up Roman numeral 28. A little bit. She says these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. That's all she highlighted on this page. I think this page needs to be super beat up if you're working with guys, because knowing this stuff is a big piece of being properly armed with the facts about ourselves when we go to talk to somebody. Because sometimes I think we act like everybody knows this stuff out there that's still drinking, and they don't. I mean, think about it. Remember when you would promise people, I'm never going to drink again, and then they'd look up and they'd see you drinking, and they'd always ask you that question. They'd ask that same question that they'd say, why'd you start drinking again? And we'd give them the only answer we've got, which is what? I don't know. God almighty, I don't know. I mean, it's just what I do. I make promises that I don't keep them, and I lie to people that I love. And by the time I get here, I'm thinking, disease, my butt, there is something bad wrong with me. Because when I made those promises, I meant it. And so it goes on and it talks about, you know, a lot of stuff I'm not even going to talk about tonight. But after all this stuff, when it talks about the phenomenon of craving, when you get over to page 23, it says these observations. What observations? All the observations about what happens when I drink would mean squat. Well, it says would be academic and pointless. But what it means is what happens to me when I drink wouldn't mean squat if I didn't take the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. This what happens when I drink is a big problem, but it's not my biggest problem. If my biggest problem was what happens to me when I drink 4 ounces of vodka, my solution would be real simple. What would it be? Just don't drink vodka. Just knock it off. Did that work for anybody? You know, Nancy Reagan's little Just Say No program would have been awesome. For Katie, Nancy Reagan was a president's wife back a long time ago. Okay, I just want to be sure. And she had a little program where she said, just say no to drugs. And it didn't work very well for me. But and it goes on, you know, to say, what happens when I drink? Here comes the second piece of alcoholism, and it's that when I don't get okay when I stop drinking. To my mother, when she would say, you know, you drink every day. You know, there's a line that says our alcoholic life seems the only normal. When she would say that, I remember thinking, Mom, everybody I know drinks every day. But, you know, and if drinking did for you what it does for me, you'd be crazy not to drink every day. Why would I ever take a day off from that? You know, and so, but what would happen is, because it seems like he's a good boy when he's not drinking, but these people don't know what happens to us when we're not drinking. When I stop drinking, my problems don't go away. In fact, it feels like somebody turns the heat up on them. I get restless. I get irritable. I get discontented. And before long, I get so uncomfortable that the obsession to drink returns. And at some point, that obsession to drink is stronger than I am. That's the second piece of alcoholism. Physical allergy coupled with the mental obsession. And what happens is I drink, and after a while, it gets really bad. And it gets really bad until I stop or I get stopped. And now I've stopped. Things are a little better. Things are going a little better. Maybe they're not going to fire me. It looks like she may not leave me. I got a little, you know, I got a little folder money in my pocket again. But after a while, I start getting a little uncomfortable. I start getting a little pissed off. You know, it says I get irritable. Now, nobody wants to be described as irritable, but it's not my fault if I've become keenly aware of how stupid everybody else is. I mean, does that happen to anybody? You know, I think that guy just gave me a look, you know, and then the guy in the grocery store has 14 items on the 10-item lane. And the reason I know it is because I counted every flipping one of them, you know, and on the wrong day, I'm the guy that's going to go, because I got to be the sheriff of the world, right? You know, I'm the guy that's going to go, so pal, which four of those items you want to put back? And if he comes back with the wrong answer, it's a bad day at the grocery store. And you know, now I'm having to explain to my family how I got arrested buying milk, you know, but by God, there's chaos in society and somebody's got to stand up for it. And if not me, who, you know? And so that's the way I'm out in the world. Now, here's the other thing I've learned from taking inventory. I'm also a hypocrite and I like double standards. So don't step to me when I got 14 items on the 10 item lane, because I got a story to go with it. You know, if you say something to me, I'm like, well, you know, technically four of those cans are green beans. So that's really just one item, you know, or something. It's always injustice. I'll throw a flag on the field for you that I got a story to go with mine. It's all over my inventories. Well, you know, after a while, so I didn't finish my terrible cycle. I drink until I have to stop, and then I stop until I have to drink, and then I drink until I have to stop, and then I stop until I have to drink. And if you're caught in this terrible cycle of alcoholism, believe me, there's a bottom below the bottom you know. I tell guys I work with, don't ever say it can't get any worse. That just shows a lack of imagination. You know, it's like in 3 years, you might look up going, man, I wish I'd quit back in 2021 when things were still going pretty good. Well, I got to get moving because I want to get through this because, well, for me, I took my first drink at 13, but I didn't really get started good till I was 16. And at 16, everything came off. The wheels came off all my, stuff and things started going downhill. I started having more and more trouble. I started dropping down academically. I went from a promising honor student to barely getting out of high school, and eventually drank myself out of the University of Texas in 1 year. And things are starting to go downhill, and I'm starting to have some legal problems, you know. And we start looking bad on paper, you know. I mean, God, when you live like I do, it's like, if you go 6 months without getting arrested, it seems like you're doing pretty good. You know, you go in front of the judge and he's like, weren't you just here 6 months ago? You know, and you're like, oh, come on, man. You know, but and things started looking bad after a while. I started crashing cars. And I started crashing a lot of cars. And I mean, well, one night I left a bar in a blackout and I crashed into a car and went running back to the house to report the car stolen and to the bar. I went back to the bar I was drinking in to report the car stolen. Now, this was not a spectacular night. This is just kind of a typical night in the life of Charlie Parker back then. But I called the car in stolen and I come home Katie thinks it's an important part of the story to tell you that it was my mother's car. I wrecked every car my mother ever owned, except for this one silver Honda. And it took me a while to remember the Honda. I was like, I didn't wreck the Honda. But you know, this time, and they call the next morning and they go, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to take a polygraph test. As I was running back from the scene of the accident to the bar, there was two cops standing out in the street and there was glass everywhere and they were shining their flashlights. And I remember thinking, man, they got here really fast, you know, but I keep running to this bar. And the next morning they said, you're going to have to take a polygraph test. I said, why? And they said, well, because the car was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, you're kidding. And they said, no, they ran into a parked police car. And I remember thinking, that explains how they got there so fast, you know, because I'd been a little foggy on that one, you know. But I mean, then other things start happening. About this time, there's a thing on page 24 in our book where it says, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Think about it. What did they just say? We all know the only requirement for membership in AA is what? A desire to stop drinking. A desire to stop drinking will get me a front row seat in any AA meeting in the world. But it says right there on page 24, it won't do a darn thing to keep me sober. It says I pass into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. I've lost the power of choice and control. Somewhere along the line, I crossed this invisible line. I don't know when it happened. I think that's why we call it an invisible line, but somewhere along the line, I lost the power of choice and control. And the way I like to describe the power of losing the power of choice and control was the pawn shops. I loved pawn shops. I loved everything about them. I mean, almost everything about them. Any other pawn shoppers on here tonight? None, just me. Okay, one little bit of hand. Okay, you know, I liked the purity of the equation of the pawn shop. I mean, he was very straightforward. You know, you just, I don't ever remember a pawnbroker looking at me and going, good God, man, what are you going to do with this money? You know, or weren't you just here this morning? Or, you know, something like that. You know, it's like you just give them the shotgun and they give you the money, and you give them the deer rifle and they give you the money. And then I had a plan. I'm not selling everything. I'm just pawning it. And I had a plan the whole time. And let me tell you, we're not dumb people. We drunks make some really good plans. In fact, I was just reminded of a joke. Anybody remember Scott Redmond? Scott Redmond was one of my favorite speakers. And he used to talk about it. He'd say, you know how we say that alcoholics have a higher IQ than the average society? And he goes, and everybody nods their head and stuff. He goes, you know, you only hear that in AA meetings. He goes, the American Medical Association is not out there going, these guys are geniuses, you know. but I mean, we make some good plans, and our plans work right up till they quit working, you know. And my plan was that I had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop. And in 90 days, I could usually pull some kind of a scam or do some kind of a deal that would get everything back, and we could keep that little cycle rolling. Well, one day I'd pulled an insurance scam, and it was enough money to get everything out of the pawn shops, you know. And so, you know, it's time to go. And but I also, Spillway Pub was the only place in Dallas at the time. Keep in mind, I live in Austin now, but Spillway was the only place in Dallas that would let me run a tab. So it's also high priority to get by the pub and settle my tab, because I'm going to need that, you know. So now I'm not going to do anything crazy. I'm certainly not going to trigger any phenomenon of craving or anything. I'm just going to go by and settle my tab, go about my business, maybe have a couple of beers. Well, I am a blackout drinker. I blacked out a lot. In fact, you know, I love this big book, and there are very few lines in our book that don't apply to me. But one of them is where it says our stories are filled with countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like normal men. I don't have any experience with that. A lot of people do. I didn't. I never was. I was about oblivion from the very beginning. And for the very first time I got loaded, I remember thinking, we're going to do this a lot, you know, and it moved to the center of my life. Well, now I blacked out several times a week. On this occasion, I come out, next thing I know, I come out of a 5-day blackout. I didn't have many of those. I had a lot of those blackouts where I don't remember the drive home. You have to look through the curtains to see if the car is in the driveway, or, wow, how do I get weeds in my bumper? You know, and those kind of blackouts. But this was 5 days of don't remember anything. And I come out of the blackout about 50 feet from where I'm sitting here tonight, upstairs in the bedroom at my mother's house. I should tell you, I was so poorly treated as a child that I ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I'm serious. Never went back. Now, I had some cribs here and there, but like any good gangster, we all wind up back at mom's house, you know. And on this morning, I come out of a blackout. Now, I've passed out with my clothes on upstairs, and I can still describe. I was looking at that area. It's different this afternoon than it was 35 years ago. But I could tell you the color of the carpet, the dresser, the clock that was on it, the wallpaper, the temperature of the room, because I come out of that blackout, and in my right pocket, I had $8. And in this left pocket, I still had all those pawn tickets. And we've all had those mornings where you're just like, oh no, oh no. Because now I got nothing, and I'm out of tricks, and I got nothing. And I'm not a sociopath. I've studied it a little bit. I'm not. I was worried there for a minute, but I'm not a sociopath, you know, and I'm not going to sell my father's. I'm extremely self-centered, I can tell you that, but I'm not going to sell my dad's shotgun for $40, you know. So I would have to go to my father, who was a good man. Nobody was giving him his stuff. And I'd have to go to my dad and go, Dad, listen, if we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail. And man, if there's any Al-Anons in the room, I have to tell that story like it's a joke. We know that ain't funny. If I touch the desperation of that morning of having to go to my dad and tell him that I've pawned all his stuff, and if we don't go get it, we're going to lose it. Because what would happen next is we'd get in his Dodge pickup truck, and Dallas is a big spread out town like Los Angeles. So it wasn't just go to the pawn shop. It was, we got to go up on East Grand and get your deer rifle. We got to go out on Buckner Boulevard, get your shotgun. We got to go out on Garland Road, get your metal detectors, your sterling silvers over at Oak Cliff. So it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And when we'd be driving around, I'd be going, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. I don't want to feel like this. I don't want you to feel like this. I will never do this again. What I didn't know riding in the truck with him that day was that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. When I was, that's the powerlessness I'm talking about in step one. I keep it real tight in step one. Do I have the power to stop drinking when I really want to? He talks about it on page 44. It says, if when drinking, you can't control the amount you take, or if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, it says you're probably alcoholic. What would happen then? I would hit the back door of their house like a cat burglar within 3 days. They'd just be like that. And off we'd go to the pawn shops again. And by the time I got to you people, my father and I had made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times. That's how cool I was. That's how slick I was when I got here. I was a burden to anyone who was unfortunate enough to love me or be associated with me. That's the guy I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought I had a little bit of a problem. I can tell you, I've learned at least 2 things since I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. One is that I had a much bigger problem than I thought I had. And the other is that AA had a much bigger answer than I was giving them credit for. I thought I had a little bitty problem, and AA probably had a teeny little answer. Turns out I had an enormous problem, and AA introduced me to the power of God, which has been an unbelievable solution. Well, so I come to AA. In the hour and a half I have left, I want to cover a couple more points. That was a joke, y'all. I come to AA and down in Austin. You know, I had drank myself out of the University of Texas, but while I was there, I'd heard about treatment. And I go down there and I go to treatment and I come to AA. That's the best thing that treatment center did, was separate me from booze, get me through the first 5 steps, introduce me to you people. And I found my home in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of the lucky ones. It's funny because Katie and I talk about this a lot. I loved the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. And the thing I didn't realize is not everybody does, right? You know, I mean, if we did a show of hands, just by the ones I can see, how many of you just loved the fellowship of AA right from the beginning? It's not that many. That was one of the lucky ones. That fellowship lifted me up and held me while I was trying to figure out how to do this deal and how to learn a few things differently. But I got a sponsor. I love Jim Fletcher for the rest of his life. He opened his world to me. He took me through the steps. And I thought I was a big book guy. You know, I mean, it's funny. Mark Houston. Now, my sponsor down is Myers R. And the twin brother of Chris R. And before that, my deceased sponsor was Mark Houston. If you don't hear me say anything else tonight, hear me say, get a hold of some Mark Houston CDs and listen to them. It'll change the way you look at Alcoholics Anonymous. I know it did, man. And Mark died in 5 days. It'll be 11 years since Mark passed away suddenly. But came into my life. We're going to talk about that, I hope. But, you know, what happened was, I mean, I'm working the steps. I'm going to meetings. I'm going to a Tuesday night big book study meeting. I made some of the amends, you know, and I'm trying to do a 10th step. If I really hurt somebody's feeling, or, you know, if I really got angry or something, I'd call and do a 10th step. But I mean, you know, but I'm having a lot of problems in sobriety. This probably didn't happen in Virginia, but I was having problems in sobriety. Physical sobriety starts to look like recovery, you know, because when I'm not drinking, my life got better. You know, I mean, I got a place to live. I bought a little house. I bought a pickup truck. I'm starting a little business. I get married. I'm always in collision with something or somebody. And I don't know why, but I mean, it was a little bit of a struggle, and I'm talking about sober. And, you know, so 2.5 years, I get married and we have a baby. And then by 4.5 years, I've blown that marriage up. That marriage is blown up. And now, you know, we got a child support check going out the door. And so I waited the appropriate amount of time, you know, to get into another relationship, right? 16 days. And I'm right into another relationship. And by 7 years, I've blown that one up. And now I got 2 divorces under my belt, 2 babies with child support checks going out the door. And my life is not going the way I want it to. It's not even going according to my values. And, you know, Marcus used to say, most people arrange their behavior around their principles. He said, we lower our standards to match our behavior. And man, when he said that, it really hit me right between the eyes, because I had lowered them, you know, pretty well, where I could get away with an awful lot. But, you know, Mark used to like to say, how do you know what you don't know? I didn't have any idea. And you think about it, how could I possibly know what I was missing? You know, that'll give you a brain cramp if you think about it. How do you know what you don't know? But it turns out I'd missed an awful lot, you know. And so at about 7 years sober, I kind of pulled away from AA. And I went into what I call a flat period. I mean, I was still very much an AA member. I was still, you know, going to meetings and very much about not drinking. And but I kind of lightened up on my rigorous honesty a little bit, you know, and little stuff at business, at work, and in relationships, and, you know, got into a dishonest marriage and that sort of thing. And frankly, the most dishonest thing about that marriage was me, you know, because she did not get what she thought she was getting in that marriage. And, you know, and I used to call it a flat period in my recovery. But really what it was untreated alcoholism. Turns out not drinking does not treat alcoholism, you know. And the book's very clear about it, but I missed it for a long time, you know. And I was working a program like the problem was alcohol, you know. And I mean, Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about it in his book, you know. He gave a talk that was turned into that book, New Pair of Glasses. And in there, he talked about this guy named Tex. And Tex had been afraid of dogs his whole life. And he was doing inventory one time, and he realized that when he was a kid, this dog had bitten him. And so, but when he inventoried it further, he remembered that he'd been chasing this little neighborhood girl across her yard when her dog came out and bit him. And he said, all my life I'd been running from dogs and chasing women, and dogs never were my problem, you know. And it's kind of like that, the way I was working that program. I'd been working a program like the problem with alcohol. And turns out alcohol wasn't my problem. Alcohol was my solution. Alcohol was the only thing I'd ever found that would ease the discomfort of a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness. So now, you know, I come in this marriage, everything looked good from the outside. We had a penthouse apartment in Manhattan, and we had a beach house in the Hamptons, and traveling. Now, Katie's my best friend. Katie's got 5 months more than me. And we were like litter mates in AA. And she's watching all these relationships go on. She's not approving of any of them, you know, but she was like my kid sister. I mean, there was zero flirtation, no sexual innuendo, believe me. And because Katie doesn't play like that. You know, Katie's always like, come on, let's keep it up here. You know, we're not going to tell those kind of jokes or that sort of thing. She just doesn't play that way. And we were like best friends. And she's watching all this stuff, and I'm calling her from all over the world. And she's just disgusted. You know, she didn't, I mean, forget about it, you know. And but the thing was, the more it bugged her, the more it tickled me, you know. I mean, but let me tell you, I had no idea we were going to wind up in a relationship, because she got a 20-year free look at me that I'm still paying taxes on. You know, I mean, all that pulling the pigtail stuff doesn't go very well when you get into a relationship. And let me tell you, it's been a lot of work. But one time we're out in the Hamptons, and we're coming back in, and we chartered a plane. I had some friends up from South Carolina, and we chartered a plane to fly us back into Manhattan. Now, I've been going to the Hamptons for years. I know people have been flying out there every weekend for a long, long time. This is the first time I ever chartered a flight in my life. And we're going to fly in. And so we take off from East Hampton Airport. We get out over the Peconic Bay. And we're flying along at about 3,500 feet. We're in a Cessna 210 with retractable landing gear. Sometimes guys like to know that information. But we're flying along. And I'm in the front seat. There's 5 adults and my dog. And we're flying along. And all of a sudden, we're in a glider. And it was like someone had turned the key off and tossed it out the window. And I'm looking around, and I felt about as safe as if I was 3,500 feet up in a soap bubble, you know. And I turned to the pilot. I'm in the co-pilot seat. Now, I'm not a co-pilot, but I'm sitting in the co-pilot seat. And let me tell you, what you don't want to hear your charter pilot saying when you put your headphones on is he was jacking this knob on the throttle going, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And I'm going, what? And they come on the radio. I could hear it through those headphones. And they say, you're cleared to Gabreski. Now, there was an airport at 10 o'clock. We're not going to make it. We're not going to clear the water. We're not going to clear the trees. And we're darn sure not going to make this runway 6 miles away. And he says, you don't understand. I've lost engine power. I can't make land. I'm going to have to ditch. I'm like, what? I mean, I'm a gambler my whole life. I love gambling. What are the odds? The first time I ever charter a plane, we're going to have to set it down into the water at night. And it was July 20th of 2003. Well, he says, brace for impact. Anybody know how to do that? Yeah, neither did I. You know, and we come in and we smash into the water. And it's there was some lights on the shore shining out over the water. And it's like splashdown at Six Flags times 1,000. There's water and spray and noise. And the windshield comes in and the cowling comes off. And then absolute silence. And I'm like, holy cow, I think we're all right. And about that time, I felt something on my knee. Now, this wasn't much of an airplane, really crappy boat, you know, and all of a sudden water just goes, and I can't get my door open. In fact, the last thing my buddies heard me say was, I can't get my door open. And I'm pushing. And I go up to get air, and there's nothing but water in the roof of the plane above my head. I'm thinking, so that's it. We die today in this blankety blank airplane. And spoiler alert, I didn't die, but I come back underwater. And I got about a half a lung full air, and I start jacking that door, and it comes open. And I'd like to tell you, my first thought was of my wife or of the other people in the plane. But when I grabbed, I could see light behind the wing as an overwing. And when I grabbed the roof and pulled like this and felt my feet come free, I promise you, my first thought was, I'm out. I'm out. And I went out and I got some air, and I went down and I pulled my wife out. And not Katie, this was a previous wife. And then I go down and I get the dog, and the two of the people go out the other side. And at one point I see five heads. And he went, well, where's the dog? It's still in the plane. I go back in. Now the whole time I'm thinking that the plane's about to go right down the bottom. Turns out it's sitting on the bottom. We're only in 11 feet of water, but we came real close to drowning. I mean, you know, because it was hairy. And so and I wound up, you know, we make it to shore, and I wound up on CNN. The call from CNN said, you know, we have this new program we'd like for you to come get interviewed on. It's this cub reporter that nobody heard of. He's trying to make a name for himself. And the show was called Live from the Headlines with Anderson Cooper. And nobody knew who Anderson Cooper was. And so we go in, and here's my buddies around the country going, is that Charlie? You know, it was no Earl Hightower story, but it was pretty flipping dramatic in my life, you know. And what happened was, we come back to Austin, and you know, this is what I like to think is hopefully the most interesting part of my story. And I always wish I'd save more time for it, because I want to talk about what happened after that, because there was a lot of things in my life that I was fixing to do. Do y'all say that in Virginia? Do y'all say fixing? Yeah, you know, fixing means I'm preparing to do something. It doesn't mean repairing. It means preparing. And there's a lot of stuff I was fixing to do. I was fixing to probably get out of that marriage. I was fixing to start working a better AA program. There's a lot of things that I talked about. Well, all of a sudden, this near-death experience had me looking at some things differently. And I knew at some level that I was in trouble, you know, and so was Katie. About this time, Katie's husband had relapsed with 23 years of sobriety and gone out and died of a heroin overdose. And it was like having somebody blown out of the foxhole right next to you. Joe was one of our partners and one of our guys. Nobody ever thought Joe would ever use again. And well, and I'm in trouble. I mean, this may not show up for you people in your lives sober, but I was a little bit self-centered. I call up this old timer when I get back to Austin. I go, John Henry, brother, I am so self-obsessed that I can't even be in a conversation with anybody. I mean, I have to force myself. If I run into John, you know, I have to go, hey, John, how are the kids? You know, ask one of those questions that you're supposed to ask, you know, and act like I give a flip about the answer, because I don't. I don't care about anything but me and me and me. I mean, I'll never forget. I'm not supposed to tell this story, but it's coming out. One time, 15 years sober, I walk in the AA club, the big AA club there in Austin, North Club, and I run into this guy that I've known a long time. And he goes, hey, Charlie, how's it going? Hey, what's up, Steve? And he goes, man, he goes, we need to go back to Vegas sometime. And I go, yeah, we really do. And I'll turn around. I can still, there's another one of those scenes where I can tell you the whole room, because I got zero memory of ever being in Vegas with this guy. And I've only ever known this guy sober, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm going, oh my God, what is, and I get to thinking about it. And one time there was a group of four men that went out to Las Vegas, and we went to shows and we gambled and we got massages and we played golf and we did all this stuff. But I wasn't in Vegas with that guy. I was in Vegas with me. And he was just one of those bit players off to the side. Bob Bazans told me one time, he goes, his first sponsor one time goes, Bob, you know those shadowy figures out there? And he goes, yeah. He goes, those are people. They have lives and concerns of their own. And you're like, what? You know, I mean, you know, so, I mean, but I just, I couldn't, and I didn't even know any of this was mentioned in our book, you know? So I come back and I start about that time, you know, I'm hanging out with Katie, because Katie's in trouble. And I'm trying to, and we're trying to get new messages. And about that time, my buddy Tom had relapsed. And he had a little pill problem. He was taking 125 Vicodin a day. And it turns out that's too many, you know? And so we 12-step Tom, I 12-step Tom with what little bit I had going on. And we get him into this treatment center down in Central Texas. And he meets this one-eyed guy named Chris R. down there. And Chris R. is talking about stuff that we've never heard before. And all of a sudden, well, when Tom comes back and I'm trying to have my new experience, our conversation started changing. It reminded me of the part in the book where it says every night, someone's house hosted a little gathering of us happy in our release, trying to figure out how to carry this message to the new man. So now I'm talking about Tom, and I'm talking to Tom like an hour every morning. Katie's a little tired of hearing about it. She's like, what do you do when they say that? Well, that's when I'll go to this page. What about when they say that? Well, have you ever heard of the bedevilments? No. What are they? Well, they're on page 52. Well, what do they say? And, you know, and we're having those kind of conversations. And there were times going out with John Henry, there were times where I felt like I was a step ahead of some of these guys that were asking me to take them through the work. Now, I'm 17 years sober at the time, and they think I know something. But there's times where I'm telling them, go home and read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And I'm going home and reading the doctor's opinion, the Bill's story. And let me tell you, one thing Mark used to say is that the ego can be put to work for good cause. And let me tell you, my ego was not going to let those guys outrun me. And you're not going to stop. Now, when you're sponsoring people, it has to be an okay answer to say, I don't know. I get nervous when everybody's got an answer to everything. Sometimes I got to go, you know what, buddy, I don't know. That's a good question. Let's get in the book, see if we can find the answer. Let me call my sponsor, see if we can figure it out. But no, you're not going to stump me with that question again. You know, that's what I mean when I say the ego can be put to work for good cause. But now I come in, and about that time when all this is going on and I'm starting to get really fired up about AA, there was an old guy at the AA club. And he goes, hey, Charlie, I heard something about a big book study up in Dallas. I go, I got some people in Dallas. Let me make a couple of calls. And somebody sent me this flyer, this big book experience with Mark H. and this other guy. And I go to Katie and I said, you know, Katie, I don't think this is what Dick was looking for, but this might be something we'd like. I said, because Mark H. is Chris R.'s sponsor. And I really like Chris R. I bet we'd like Mark H. And just like that, God picks me and Katie up and moves us up to Denton, Texas for this weekend workshop. Found out later that Mark Houston hadn't given a talk in 3 years. He'd been in a 3-year silence, and God picks us up, puts us together in the same room for that weekend, and it changed my life. Mark Houston introduced me to a power that has blown the roof off of my program. And I used to feel embarrassed to talk about how much I'd missed till I realized how much company I had. You know, I'm not going to have much time to talk about it, but I do want to talk about it a little bit, you know, because all of a sudden it was a whole nother level. And then, you know, one of the biggest mistakes I think we make in Alcoholics Anonymous is we take somebody, it turns out step one meant something different than I thought it meant. Step three meant something way different than I thought it meant. And I think the biggest mistake we make in AA is bringing somebody in and going, are you alcoholic? Do you believe in God? And then right after the ABC, it says, alcoholic can't manage my own life. Probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. See that God could and would if he were sought. Then go straight to the third step prayer. Get down on our knees, do the third step prayer. And let's start writing inventory. I had no idea what I was looking for in that inventory. It was kind of like just a big confession. Well, that was my experience, and that's a ton of people's experience. And that's how I think I wound up working a program like The Problem Was Alcohol, because when you do that, you skip this body of work from pages 60 to 63. And it's not really very important. It's just the root of my problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life. Other than that, just skip it and let us know how it goes for you. And that's why I was, and it says, you know, right after that A, B, and C, it says, you know, being convinced we were at step three, being convinced of what? A, B, and C. And then it says the first requirement of step three is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Let me tell you, I still remember the first time I saw that line, because not only was I not convinced of that, that line had never touched me, because we went right from, are you alcoholic? Do you believe in God? To the third step prayer. And now all of a sudden I start reading this stuff and I start having a new experience. Katie's sponsor is brilliant. She brought these pages to life. Mark Houston, Chris, Myers. And all of a sudden this self piece is introduced into my alcoholism. And it says on that basis, I'm almost always in collision with something on the basis of self-will. We call it the second surrender. The first surrender in AA is the surrender to alcohol, but it's easy to surrender when you've had your butt kicked, you know, when a gorilla's got his foot on your throat. But the second surrender usually comes for most of us after we've been banging around these rooms for a while, trying to manage my life sober. And the collapse of self-will and sobriety doesn't feel like, oh boy, I'm about to have a spiritual awakening. It feels like everything I've based my life on is blowing up in my hands. And I feel about as secure as if I was free falling backwards into black space, not knowing what's going to catch me. And that's where I find myself. And all of a sudden, and you know, when it says like, you know, always in collision, now it changed everything. It changed everything. It even changed my past. You know, if you'd asked me what happened in that first marriage, I would have told you she cheated on me. And I don't roll like that. And you get a lot of support for that crap in the rooms of alcoholics. And you might even find somebody to tell you, well, you just got a broke picker. You know, like, oh, you poor baby. You know, you just keep picking the broke, you know. No, I am. If you ask me now what happened in that marriage, I would tell you that I was so selfish and self-centered that it would have driven anybody crazy and would have driven anybody out the door. And now all of a sudden, my problems are of my own making. One of the biggest promises in the book is where it says, so our problems, we think, are basically of our own making. Because if my problems are of my own making, if my problems are of y'all's making, the only way I'm ever going to be okay is if I can get y'all to act right. And I have very little experience getting everybody to act right. But if my problems are of my own making, me and this power and the new perspective that can come as a result of this work can change my whole experience. And it just took off and took everything. I mean, could I have about 3 or 4 more minutes, David? You know, about that time we started a Thursday night meeting at the house we call the Common Solution. We've been meeting, some of the boys are on here tonight. We've been meeting for 15 years probably, and we want to be one voice, one message, whoever, whether you're talking to me or Carl or Tony or John or Todd or Chad, whoever, hopefully you're getting kind of the same message coming right out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And man, the first time Mark came to the meeting, I'll never forget it. I got a new sponsor, and then we started the meeting before Mark came along. Now my sponsors are like, Charlie's got a new sponsor. You know, let's see what's going to happen. You know, and the first time you meet with a new sponsor, what do you figure you're going to do? I figure probably going to write inventory, right? Well, Mark sits down at the table and he's looking at all of us and he goes, tell me, guys, where are you at with the amends process? And I said what a drunk says when they're trying to think of an answer. I said, what? And he said, where are you guys at with the amends process? And I'm like, I tried to bullshit my way through an answer, you know? And he goes, I sense that there's a significant experience available for you men in the amends process. And we're all looking at each other like, this guy's like Svengali or something. I mean, how does he know that? And well, it's because nearly all of us have a significant experience available in the amends process. And all of a sudden with Mark, I mean, we're talking about making all of our amends, actually making all of our amends. We're writing out cards and we're putting people's names on them. And the three questions that we ask after an amends, maybe we can get to that later. But I can tell you that at 17 years sober, I had 42 amends cards. And I'll never stand up here and tell you that I've made amends to everyone I've ever harmed. But I can tell you I've made amends to everyone I'm aware of. When they come up, they go on a card and I go make that amends. And I never would have thought there was freedom in that. Now I'm sponsoring guys and I'm watching for guys. And I mean, real alcoholics are drawn to real solution. All of a sudden you start talking to solution and meetings and stuff. People are coming up to you going, hey man, can we talk after the meeting and stuff? And you're like, yeah, you got a big book. And I mean, my life took off from that point. I mean, and everything changed. I mean, we're sponsoring guys and having the meetings, we're doing amends, actually doing 10 and 11, you know, evening review, doing the 10th step throughout the day, spot check inventory. Not evening review is not the 10th step. The 10th step is a spot check inventory through the day. I take that into my evening review. I ask God to help me with it. I look for corrective measures. I take those into my morning meditation. I get a plan for the day, and then I go out throughout the day. This program gives me something to do in the morning, at night, and all through the day, every flipping day of the year. And things change like crazy. All I can tell you is that for the last 18 years, I have been on fire with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life has never been better, and I almost missed it. I mean, if I'd have died in that plane crash, I would have missed it. If you'd have come to me when I had 17 years of sobriety and said, Charlie, what's going to change your life and set you on fire is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous coming right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you you're crazy, man. I've been in AA for 17 years. I know what AA has to offer me. I'm telling you, I'd barely stuck a toe in the water. One of the biggest lies AA speakers ever tell you is, I'll close with this. But, you know, I'm an NFL football fan. I assume we're all Dallas Cowboy fans here. And, you know, I've been a fan of the Cowboys since they were good. My office looks like a shrine to the Cowboys. And you know, and one year, one of my sponsors says, you know, my family's got a skybox at Texas Stadium. And I said, oh, good for you. And then he calls me one day and goes, hey, you want to go to Monday Night Football against the Eagles? And I said, yes, I do. Yes, I do. And we go to this special parking lot, go in a private little entrance up this quiet little escalator down a private little hallway. And we're in the skybox and there's warm cookies and ice and waiters and Charles Haley, five-time Super Bowl champion, sit there. And I'm like, I don't know whether to be excited about sitting in that skybox or to be pissed off about having sat in the cheap seats for 20 years. Turns out that was exactly my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'd have died in that plane crash, I would have missed the whole thing. If there's any newcomers here with us tonight, we love you. We're glad you're here. We hope you stay with us and be a part of our program. But there's plenty of message for the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here to talk to the what I call middle management, the guy that's got 5 years, 15 years, 25 years, and you're not feeling what you hear people describing in some of these AA meetings. I'm here to tell you, it's still available. And it's available as a result of getting with somebody that's done the work out of this book and saying, would you show me what to do? I don't know what to do. I mean, on page 152, there's a quote in the big book that says, the most satisfactory years of our existence lie ahead of us. Ask yourself, is that my current belief? Is that my current experience? Or does it feel like it peters out after 5 or 10 or 15 years? It's real simple. If you've got this message, get out and share it. And if you need it, come get it. What's stopping you? I'm Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, everybody.
Oh, thank you, Charlie. That was amazing. Everyone is allowed to unmute briefly and just say thanks to Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. Have you ever spoken in Norfolk or Virginia Beach?
Yes.
All right, kids, I'm going to take the meeting back and we'll give Charlie a breather and do a little bit of business here. So I've posted a link in the chat. Also a reminder, if you've got some questions, please send them to the user questions. It's really Larry. Larry is waiting to receive your questions. Please use the chat to send questions to the user questions. And I've placed a link in there in accordance with the seventh tradition. The Simple Actions Group is observing the seventh tradition. The seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will take a couple of announcements for the good of AA by show of hands. Anybody?
Just put the information for our home group on Wednesday night. We'd love for you to join us for our big book study.
Thank you, Charlie. Anybody else? Lisa B, come on, girl.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. Every Tuesday at 12:30, we have a meeting for women at the Norfolk City Jail. We're looking for people to host, share, or just be there. We just need women, but it is, you have to have a year of sobriety. So if it's all right, I'll put my number, my information in the chat. And if, just get a hold of me or contact corrections@tidewaterinnergroup.com and I will answer your email. Thank you.
Yep. corrections@tidewaterinnergroup.org. Ebony, you got an announcement?
Yes, I do. Hey, y'all. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. Charlie, thank you so much for that. I'm just lit up right now. Get my words together. The fourth Wednesday of this month, District 14, Norfolk is hosting a 12 concepts workshop. 12 concepts, 12 traditions, 12 steps. Don't know what the concepts are? It's a great place to show up and find out. On the 24th of this month, we're having Dave H., who's the alt chair of the Virginia Area Committee. He will be speaking on concept 2. He'll share for about 20 to 30 minutes. We'll take a mini break and then we'll open up for some Q&A. Questions have put the info in the chat for us and I hope to see you there. That is the fourth Wednesday of this month. Thanks.
Thank you, Ebony. Leo, I thought I saw your hand, brother.
Yeah, that was Wednesday. Meeting at Centenary Methodist Church. The church and group is meeting live and we follow the rules set down by the church. So we got no problems with that. Everybody wears a mask, all that. That's in church and on near the library on Sunday on Cedar Lane.
All right. Thank you, Leo. All right. Thank you all. And let's see. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or need a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. And sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available in this meeting after we close. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right, so let's see. I've closed the chat back up. And, Charlie, that was fantastic. Please keep your questions coming in. We've got a few. We need some more. Charlie, I got to know, brother, did the dog make it out of the plane?
That was the only non-survivor. He died the next day. We actually did mouth-to-snout resuscitation on him and had him breathe in for about 24 hours, but he just had too much salt water in his lungs.
Yeah.
Final dog, too.
So we didn't get to talk about it much, but you really, I don't know, you got my ears burning on that third step position and the way that we gloss over it and the root of my troubles. And I don't know, is there any more to pick apart there?
Is there? God bless you for giving me a minute to talk about it. You know, we do a ton of workshops and, you know, it's funny, I skipped those pages for so long. And now I think my sponsors are going, oh no, you know, I got a sponsor that's only read 3 pages out of the big book, you know, because we spend so much time here. But it goes on to say that I'm on the basis of self-will, I'm almost always in collision. Now, for a long time, I would read about that actor trying to run the whole show and didn't get anything out of it. Anybody else? Just like nothing. Well, one of the things I didn't realize for a long time is the reason he's such a pain in the neck is because he's just an actor. He's not the director. He's just supposed to stand on the X and say his line, but this is me as I want to run the whole show. I got opinions about everything. You know, I go in the grocery store and I'm like, why do they put the bean dip over here and the Fritos over here? And I like to form a really strong opinion based on a limited perspective, you know? And then, you know, I say the sound of an alcoholic changing your mind is when you explain it to me, I go, huh, okay. You know, but I mean, in the meantime, outrage, you know, and it goes on. And this delusion that if only my arrangements would stay put, people would be pleased. And then it talks about that toolkit of self-will, page 61, where I'm always trying to get things to go my way. I'm kind, generous, modest, or I'm overbearing, mean, egotistical. But it's all me trying to get things to go my way. And it would be fine, except for what usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. I become angry, indignant. Self-pity. I start feeling like life isn't treating me right. Anybody recently felt like life's not treating you right? You know, I mean, come on, you know, and it goes on to say, I'm a self-seeker, a victim of the delusion that I can seize happiness if I manage well enough. And then it switches over. But the big thing about it is in 62, it says selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our trouble. Marcus, down here below where it says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. And Mark looked me dead in the eye one day and he goes, Charlie, what do the words above everything mean to you? It doesn't even say above everything, we got to stop drinking vodka. It's saying, if I don't conquer this self-centeredness, I'm going to get so uncomfortable that I'm going to. And now the wonderful package of untreated alcoholism and the bedevilments is that I get to be miserable and make everybody associated with me miserable in the time between that last drink and the time I drink again or blow my brains out. You know, that's the wonderful package of untreated alcoholism is, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving, you know, and I don't know that it's selfishness and self-centeredness. And so the thing about it, I'm trying to make this a short answer, but the reason I missed that self-piece was because when I read the book, I'm not looking for new information. I'm looking for confirmation of ways I'm already right. So when I see stuff that's not part of my current understanding, I just let it go right over my head. Well, if I miss the self-piece at step 3, when you get over to step 4, it says, being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us, that's a statement we turn into a question. Am I convinced of that? If I'm convinced that self is what it defeated me, we look at the common ways that self shows up. Now my inventory turns into an examination of the common ways that self manifests: resentment, fear, selfishness in my sex conduct, that sort of thing. If I missed it in the 4th step, where did I miss it? You know, at the end of how it works chapter, it says, we hope you are now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you from it. You know, I missed it there. When you get to the eighth step, it says we attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live life on self-will and run the show ourselves. My God, I mean, talk about asleep dreaming I was awake. And I couldn't figure out why I was struggling. This self-peace changes everything. I mean, it changes the way I do a 10th step, changes the way I hear a 10th step, changes the way I hear inventory. I'm always looking at it from a different angle. John can tell you that we're in the entirely different angle. John called me with a 10th step this week. He thought he was going to stump me with this one. He's like, he's not going to be able to help me with that one, you know. He came away going, you know, I mean, we feed it to each other, but I mean, rather than just saying, here's how you deal with a difficult coworker, we're looking at, where did you make decisions based on self? Where did you set the ball rolling? How are you involved in this? What's an entirely different angle to look at this? And it changes, the freedom comes. If I'm going to be free, the problem's got to be me.
So on 62, he tells us, you know, first of all, we got to quit playing God because it doesn't work. You know, what does playing God look like for you? How do you describe that to people?
Well, if playing God is working out real good, rock on, you know. But I mean, for me, the way I play God is I know how everything needs to go. Anybody else? I mean, I know where things ought to be in the grocery store. I know who I should be able to get. I know how much money I should be able to make. I know which jobs I should get, which jobs I shouldn't get. I know when somebody should die or shouldn't die. I can tell you if a death is a tragedy or if it's, you know, I mean, I have an opinion on everything. And most of that stuff is above my pay grade. And I'll screw myself into the ground trying to manage all of it. But I'm, you know, playing God is a big job. You know, it'll have you fall into bed exhausted every night going, I don't know if I can do this for another day, you know. And if anybody asks me how I'm doing, I go, fine. Yeah, I'm fine. Fine. Yeah.
Thank you. We have a question here. Have you ever had a resentment that won't go away even after inventorying and making amends?
Well, in 10 and 11, it talks about watching and turning, watch, turn, you know, and there's a big difference between waiting and watching, you know. So if I'm in a wet foxhole on a battlefield, it's one thing to be sitting there waiting for the enemy. It's another thing entirely to be looking out, you know, and watching. And I got to watch for these things when they crop up and then not let them dig in. You know, if the enemy gets to dig in, they're hard to get a shot at. You know, so as soon as these resentments pop up, you know, and now I'm a believer in multiple inventories, you know, and I also am a believer in multiple fifth steps. You know, if I was to write a four-column inventory now, I might read it to John and read it to my sponsor and read it to Katie's sponsor. I mean, and I get different perspectives sometimes, but you know, there's freedom in that process, especially if you get somebody that's taking it through that sick man exercise and seeing it from an entirely different angle. Now, the problem with these resentments is sometimes I don't want to let them go. And the book is real clear on who suffers as a result of these resentments, you know, and it's not like, you know, the idea of a justified resentment needs to be left to people that are better qualified to handle it than I am. You know, because it's not like I could go down to some office somewhere and get issued a special permit for this resentment. You know, I mean, it's like this one will kill you just as dead as the ones that you don't, you know, and I've seen people where like, yeah, but this, and when we see them, that other person is perhaps spiritually sick. Sometimes even the most horrible thing somebody's done to me, I don't have to like go hang out with them. But it's not that hard to get to a place of they were perhaps spiritually sick, because somebody who was spiritually connected wouldn't have been able to exhibit that behavior. And if we can get rid of the resentment, we're just left with sadness of something bad that happened. And God can handle sadness.
We got quite a few questions around the amends, and I I love the way when Mark came into the room and said, what was it, a significant experience awaits you with the amends? I wonder if you have any favorite amends stories or things that happened after that around the amends in your sobriety.
So many. Mine and others. I mean, some dramatic ones, some funny ones. I mean, I remember calling to make an amends to a restaurant I'd left without paying. And he said, when was that? And I said, best of my memory, 1978. And he goes, you know what? Let's don't worry about it. And I said, well, let me just tell you, it was really selfish and I'm really sorry. And I said, I tell you what, next time I come through Waco, I'll come eat at your restaurant. And he goes, okay, just be sure to pay for it. But there were other ones where, I mean, some the most difficult amends are the personal ones, not the money ones. It's the ones where I kind of look like an asshole going in and I still feel like an asshole going out. You know, there's some amends where I've just really harmed somebody and all I can do is say, I'm, you know, so sorry. Is there anything I can do to help make it right? Do you want to tell me how that made you feel? Have I harmed you in any other way? Those are the three questions we ask after an amends, and those are powerful, life-changing questions. Because a lot of times I might think I got this little amends to make, and I don't have any idea how I've harmed those people. Had plenty of those. One of my favorites is when I sat down to make amends with Katie, I made amends for all the things that I was aware of. And at the end of the amends, I said, now, honey, Mark used to say living a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness, we have very little concept of our effect on other people. And so at the end of that amends with Katie, I said, now, honey, as self-centered as I am, it's possible that I've harmed you in ways I'm not aware of. And I know I sprung this on you, but I'd like to give you some time to think about it. And if there are other things I've done to harm you, I'd like to sit down and have that conversation. And she said, okay. Well, I go off good and along like I'm on my merry way. And one day I said, am I the only one that brings up some of the dumbest stuff you've ever done to your significant other? You know, I mean, and I go, hey, honey, remember that time I, and she goes, oh yeah, I remember. She goes, it's on the list. I said, what list is that? And she goes, you told me I could go make a list. And I go, oh, now hold up. I said, I meant like a week, you know, this was 7 months later. And she, the whole time, anytime something happened, that's like, that reminds me of the time he did this, the time he called me that, it reminds me of the time he touched that waitress's hair, and it, you know, and just this and that. So now the cat's out of the bag, and we sit down. When I say the power of that question, have I harmed you in any other way? We sat down at the corner of my table, and she started her list. And I started writing them down. There were 32 items on her list. Every one of them was a legitimate harm. And not one of them was on my amends list. That's the power of that question. Have I harmed you in any other way? And then shut up and listen. You know, can I do anything to make this right? Shut up and listen. You know, and do you want to tell me how this made you feel? And shut up and listen. It's powerful stuff.
I'm stuck on that time you touched the waitress's hair.
Oh, not smart.
I didn't mean anything.
Oh, your hair is so soft.
Are there, we're getting short on time. I'm not going to get to all the questions. Are there things that you say to new folks at meetings when you're talking one-on-one, typically or specifically?
Yeah, new folks, we're going to go to this, first of all. And we're going to figure out if he's in the right room and you know, and let him know what's wrong with him. And, you know, and then we'll talk, you know, and kind of like it talks about in the first 7 pages of working with others, you know, describing that first visit. And then it comes back on the second visit is when we're going to let him have it. But that first visit is mostly about this and what we got and just letting him identify.
Allergy obsession. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're okay. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Can you give some examples of selfishness or delusion in your step 10? And specifically, the other part of the question is, what comes up consistently?
Oh, my God. You know, listen, I don't have to be anywhere until Friday. So if you guys want to ask some questions, but we have so much fun talking about these manifestations of self. And I'm going to tell you a couple of my favorites. And it's one of my favorites is called story stealing. And as a manifestation of self. And story stealing is where you start a story, but your story reminds me of one of my stories. And my story, it turns out, is way more interesting than your story. So I come right over the top. It's like, in the way I heard one time we were at a party and this guy goes, "Hey, Charlie, what's up?" I go, "Hey," and he goes, "We're getting ready to go to Costa Rica." And I go, "Costa Rica? Man, I've been to Costa Rica 3 times. I went down there with 14 of my friends one time. We did this, we did that. We went here, we went there. Oh my God, you're going to love Costa Rica." And I spin around and walk away. And this poor bastard's standing there, and he never got to tell his Costa Rica story because I stole it. And it's rampant in AA. It's like, as soon as you say something that reminds me of something, I just come right over the top of it. And one time I was talking, now the first cousin of story stealing is what we call having your hand up while somebody's talking. And that's where if David's telling me a story and it's reminding me of something, I might as well be sitting there with my hand up in the air waiting for my turn to talk. You know, and one time Katie was talking at the table and she could see that I'm not listening. And she goes, "Put your hand down, honey. I'm still talking." And I felt myself let out air because I'd already drawn in air so that if she surrendered the floor for a second, I could come right in, you know, and with my story. And so the story stealing, the having your hand up. And so one time Katie says, "You got to learn to be an active listener." We had a workshop up in the Northeast. She goes, "You have to learn to be an active listener." I mean, this is how selfish we are. She says, when somebody's talking, you have to listen to them, what they're saying, and then ask 3 questions. And then you can talk about, you know, what you're going to talk about. And so in the break, this guy comes running up to the front and he's got his pad and his pen in his hand. He goes right up to Katie. He goes, "What are the 3 questions? And she goes, "Well, you big dodo, it depends on what the story's about. But I mean, you know, it's like, you know, how long have you been planning a trip to Costa Rica? Who are you going with? What are you going to do while you're down there?" But I was laughing about him saying that. And one of my sponsees was there. And he goes, "Charlie, I think about half the room was wondering what the 3 questions are." You know, I mean, because that's still hard for me. I tell sponsees when they're going home to their family, here's what I want you to do. I want you to listen to them talk. And then ask them a question and then listen to their answer and then ask a follow-up question to that question. And they come back going, "Wow, it's the most amazing visit I've ever had with my family." You know, yes, because you shut up for a second. You know what I mean? It's like, I just find myself fascinating. And oh my God, when you start looking for manifestations of self, I can tell you the first place they're going to be apparent is in others. I can spot it in John. I can spot it in Tony. I can spot it in everybody. Now I'm blind to it in myself. So that's why I have to have a sponsor that feeds it back to me, just like I've been feeding it to John. You know, and you go, whoops, I accidentally muted myself. Well, the manifestations itself are all over the place, you know, hypocrite, double standards, interrupting, not listening, not good at hearing it, but you know, it's all over the place.
So we just persistently keep looking.
There'll be no shortage of material. Believe me, it's like, wow, you know, think about, you know, I always tell guys, if you don't think you got any selfishness or delusional thought, how'd you like to have a couple of speakers hooked up to your brain that broadcast your thoughts as you're moving through the world? You know, I mean, is that horrifying? You know, because I mean, I'm going through, I got an opinion on everything, and I can think, you know, at Starbucks, you're like, they're like, "Oh, I'll be right back with your coffee, sir." "Well, I bet you will. For $4.70, I'll be able to get a cup of coffee the way I want it." And, you know, and then this guy in front of me has got to order the hoppa loppa frappa papa, and you know, and all this, and, you know, and all this stuff is going on. And then when they hand me my coffee, and what I say is, "Thank you. You have a nice day." You know, they don't know all this, you know, but I mean, it's the stuff that drives me, you know. Yeah, no shortage of material.
Thank you so much. I hope, Charlie, I hope you had a good time. This was just absolutely amazing. And the 90 minutes has flown. So we'll give everybody a chance to thank Charlie again after the Lord's Prayer.
There's got to be one more question somebody's dying to ask.
Oh. Do you like being a member of a home group, Charlie?
Oh my God, yeah, I love the primary purpose group. It's the greatest AA group in the world, and I hope you feel the same way about your group. Yeah, home group and a home group commitment. And could you tell it's my home group? Do I go to group conscience? You know, that's, yeah, it's a huge benefit of being a part of the fellowship of this program. You know, one of the three sides of our triangle is the fellowship and service and recovery. And I was working a program based on one side of the triangle, hoping for the results of all three. When you get in the three legacies, this thing just explodes.
Thank you so much. I wonder if I could have a volunteer. Leanne, would you please read the last three paragraphs on page 164? Oh, wait a minute. I probably didn't allow you to unmute. My fault.
Thanks, David.
There we go. Thank you.
My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leanne.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Leanne. Thank everybody for a wonderful meeting.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Charlie. That was amazing. How about we virtually circle up and virtually hold hands and actually say the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come.
Thy will be done
on earth
as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,
the power, and the glory,
forever and ever. Amen.
Amen. Oh, thank you so much. That was amazing. What was the story stealing? What was the second one?
Having your hand up while somebody's talking.
Having your hand up. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie, so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlie.
That was awesome.
That's a good way to end the weekend. Thank you.
I'm sorry my mom didn't walk by while we were on here.
I was looking forward to it.
I can show you a picture. She walked by a meeting that I was talking at yesterday.